I'm pretty good. Testing voice levels. Testing voice levels. Testing. This can go down a little bit. Testing voice levels. Testing voice levels. Testing voice levels. Testing voice levels. We're just testing voice levels here. See how they sound. It's important to make them sure they sound good. And I even hear myself when I'm on hold, which is pretty good. This doesn't affect the on hold. This doesn't affect the on hold. But I hear myself pretty good. And this is just a test. Just a test. I want you to know the details of its various contracts with corporations that are helping it out in Iraq. Now, I think the information that you're going to hear this hour will really surprise you and will really shock you, actually. Even if you're a hardened Democrat who's preconditioned to believe that the president only does things to help out his corporate buddies, even you, I think, will be surprised by the information you're about to hear on this broadcast. And if you're a moderate or a conservative, I actually think you'll be surprised by the incredible links between the Bush administration, the corporations running Iraq, and the money going back to the Republican Party as a thank you, if you will, for the intense profits which American taxpayers are giving these companies. The subject today is war profiteering. And as I said, the things we're going to discuss today with my guest, her name is Antonia Juhasz. She is a project director for the International Forum on Globalization, I think will surprise you. Ms. Juhasz has documented orders that the provisional government that we set up in Iraq left behind, orders which ensure that American corporations will continue to control Iraq for decades to come, and that all the money going from American taxpayers will go to these big American businesses with very little left over for either the Iraqi people or the American people. She's also documented how these companies, thankful for the money they're getting from taxpayers, are busily helping Republicans in the election of 2004. It's really extraordinary stuff, and I want to invite you to participate and ask your questions. All you have to do is dial in toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can do, as so many of you like to do, contribute to the blog. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com. Click on today's show. I think you'll be very surprised by what you're about to hear. But first, let me welcome my guest, Antonia Juhasz, to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Listen, I've been reading some of the things that you've been writing in the Los Angeles Times, and, you know, I'm a hardened Democrat. I'm preconditioned to think this is an administration that helps out corporations. I got to say, even I was surprised by the scope of some of the things that you were describing, particularly the orders left in place by the provisional government that the United States set up in Iraq. You know, George Bush kept talking about, oh, he's turning over sovereignty to the Iraqis and Alawi's in charge and, you know, we're out of there. We're not controlling their lives anymore. I guess that's not true, is it?
No, it's not true. And, you know, I like the way you frame the discussion that this is something, even if you're hardened to believe that the administration is not looking after the Iraqis' best interest, you're going to be surprised by it, because I certainly was. The more I learned about the economic invasion of Iraq, the more I've definitely come to see it as certainly on par with the military invasion of Iraq, and probably an invasion that's going to have even more lasting impacts than the military invasion. But basically, the United States, the Bush administration, set up a government in Iraq called the Coalition Provisional Authority that was run by a U.S.-led administrator whose name was Paul Bremer, the most well-known, probably the most well-known person in the face of U.S. Policy in Iraq. And Bremer's actually been called by the United Nations Special Envoy who operated in Iraq the dictator of Iraq, and for good reason. He single-handedly, just in his own authority, not having to talk to anybody else, not having to work with Iraqis, passed exactly 100 orders that are basically laws, and they're laws that are left behind in Iraq that govern everything, everything in life in Iraq, everything from car horns to the privatization of the economy. And it's important to note first that this was a very state-controlled economy, probably most akin to a socialist economy, which was doing prior to the first war, the first U.S. Gulf War and the sanctions against Iraq, was doing very well. It was ranked very highly among nations in terms of GDP and living standards. Healthcare was guaranteed, education was guaranteed, services were provided, and it was actually doing quite well. Obviously, that has nothing to do with the human rights situation in Iraq, and we can talk more about that.
Well, just let me stop you right there, because certainly any time you were to say something like this to a Republican talk show host, he would immediately say, hey, you know, Michael Moore's movie showed happy children in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. That's disgusting that he would show something like that, given all the terrific human rights violations by Saddam Hussein's government. How much did the clear atrocities that Saddam Hussein did while he was in power, how much did that infect the ordinary Iraqi citizen that wasn't trying to overthrow the government?
Well, so there's two pieces. There's just two sides to this equation. The first is the horrific political repression that Hussein basically, you know, all of the stories are true, anyone that I've ever heard, you know, just murdered, tortured, and abused anyone in his population who he felt was a threat, period.
Okay.
However, he also was the president of Iraq for a very long time, during which time one of the things he did do together with his government was use the vast sums of oil wealth that he had not only to build weapons, but also to put a tremendous amount of money and investment into Iraq in terms of infrastructure for water, electricity, and other services, and in terms of the provision of services. He believed in the state-controlled government controlled by him. He was a dictator. But in that position, he also did provide for, and very well, comparatively speaking to other countries around the world, for the necessities of his populace, including...
Was there clean water? Did the sewers run? Things like that? Did they work?
Yeah, very, very well, actually.
Okay.
We have one of the most sophisticated water systems in the Middle East, and one of the highest rates of literacy. Iraq had the highest percentage of college-educated people in the entire Middle East prior to the first Gulf War. It had one of the highest literacy rates, one of the highest health standard rates, and that was because all of these services were guaranteed by the government.
Yeah, I think it's an important point, because I think sometimes people say he was a vicious dictator, which he was, no question about it, did awful, awful things to his political opponents, massacred the Kurds, and then they assume that it was, you know, like a concentration camp. No, it, you know, like most dictatorships on earth, there's good and there's bad, and there's dictators that are better or worse. Again, I'm not defending Saddam Hussein, but I do think it's important when we understand what Iraq is facing now to understand that at least prior they had a semblance, if they didn't oppose the government, that is, they had a semblance of normal life. All right, let me move on to the question of the orders that Paul Bremer put in place. Give me an example of some of these orders and what they did.
I will, and the only reason to bring up, as you say, what conditions were like before is certainly not in defense remotely of Saddam Hussein.
Absolutely not.
But rather to make the comparison.
Okay.
So basically what happened when Bremer came into place is that he aggressively sought to completely and overnight transform the Iraqi economy into a capitalist fantasy of free economic policies that would open the door to U.S. corporate access and essentially shut off any mechanisms for guaranteeing that any of that access would actually benefit Iraq in the reconstruction. So, for example, there's one order that requires free access and entry to U.S. corporations and makes it impossible to require that Iraqi companies get any of the reconstruction contracts, impossible to require that any Iraqis be hired in the reconstruction, and rather allows that every penny that U.S. corporations earn in the reconstruction or earn in Iraq can be returned immediately to the United States. None of it has to be reinvested.
Now, that's interesting to me because we have lots of companies in the Arab world. I know we have companies in Saudi Arabia and so forth. When a company goes to Saudi Arabia, say an oil company, are they required to leave some of that money, some of that investment in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I mean, most countries in the world require a certain portion of local reinvestment. And or they do other things, and these are all the tools that were essentially scrapped from Iraq. They require that foreign companies partner with local companies, so again, guaranteeing that there's some local benefit. And what happens more often than not is when the foreign corporation picks up and leaves, there's still something left behind, and that's either a partner or money or some sort of reinvestment that's happened in the economy.
But you're saying that Paul Bremer, our dictator in Iraq for over a year, put in place an order that would prevent Iraqi companies from having preventing the Iraqi government from giving preference to their own people in contracts. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And in hiring, which has proved to be devastating. So basically we've got U.S. corporations with multi-billion dollar reconstruction contracts in Iraq, which the first thing to say is there was and is, continues to be, immense local knowledge that's been completely jumped over. So, you know, there are experts and engineers who have been running the water and electricity systems in Iraq for decades. They were completely skipped over, and Bechtel Corporation, based where I live in San Francisco, got a $3 billion contract to rebuild the water and electricity. They did not work with the Iraqis. They didn't hire large numbers of Iraqis, nor did any of the other companies that came in, and nor did the U.S. government. Other people expected that there would be basically a public works program that would hire people up.
And Ted, I don't understand that, because these corporations, their job is to make money, and here you've got local people on the ground who certainly know the local water system better than an American. And more importantly, if I'm a big corporation and all I care about is the bottom line, I would think I could hire Iraqi workers a lot cheaper than I could hire Americans. So given that, why haven't they hired Iraqis?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I find the most confusing, because it certainly doesn't follow businesses following their bottom line. Basically, I've heard several explanations. One is, the most depressing part is, there's very little reconstruction that's actually happening. So one of the reasons why there aren't a lot of Iraqis getting hired is because there isn't much work being done on the ground. Which is the most devastating part.
Actually,
of this whole story.
Yeah, as John Kerry has pointed out, and maybe you have the exact statistics, very little of the money that was appropriated for reconstruction has been spent. They've criticized John Kerry immensely for wanting to pay for the $87 billion, not wanting to support it if it wasn't paid for, and accused him of not supporting that money, which went to reconstruction. But my understanding is very little of those funds have been spent.
Yeah, the money is a very disturbing path to follow. There were two pots of money for the reconstruction. One was Iraqi oil money, $18 billion, which was handed over to the coalition provisional government and was supposed to be spent on reconstruction. That money has basically all been spent. There's about $2 billion of it left. Nobody knows where that money went. It wasn't accounted for.
Really?
So that's gone somewhere. We're not sure where.
And this is money for oil?
Money that was left over from the oil for food program that Iraq had.
I see.
And so it was a pot of money that got transferred to the
to someone.
U.S. And it got spent on something.
All right.
I've heard that people think, and again, the money has not been accounted for, that part of Bechtel's contract has already been paid out of that money. Part of Halliburton's $18 billion contract, some of that has been paid out of that money.
Sounds like a slush fund. Who's in charge of this fund? Who is accountable in the United States government for where this money goes?
Paul Bremer, who now no longer holds a position anymore, would have been the person accountable.
Okay. Did we leave that money in Iraq when Paul Bremer left?
The money's gone.
Okay. I hear you.
Yeah,
it's gone.
It's gone. And yeah, there's one accounting that's starting to take place of that money.
Who's doing that?
it's been an inspector general has been hired to try and account for that money.
A Pentagon inspector general, or
I think the inspector general in general was appointed by the Pentagon, but it's a private company.
Okay.
It's a private company that I'm forgetting the name, but that has been accused of having ties to.
Okay. There's so much, many questions that I have, and luckily we have Antonia here the entire hour, which is good because there's a lot of questions more that I have, but I want to get some of my callers involved. If you want to call in and ask this real experts about some really extraordinary stuff that you probably haven't heard outside the Inside Scoop. I know you've heard the Democrats complain about Halliburton, but do you know the details? Do you know how much money Halliburton is getting and where that money is going? Some, even Antonia, as you hear, doesn't know where it's going because it hasn't been accounted for. And then how it comes back, how it helps Republicans, how we installed orders in Iraq that infect it to this day, that actually prevent it from becoming a democracy. There's lots of questions here. Feel free to call in. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Antonia Yuhas.
Dave, on the Internet, Mark, another excellent program.
Thank you.
I have arrived at the bottom line that this administration was placed in power by a very greedy cartel of wealthy corporatists, and that
strictly it was five members of the Supreme Court that put them in power, but I get your point. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, and everything that they have done thereafter has been an attempt to benefit that very wealthy group of greedy corporatists, and I am coming to the conclusion that that is the sole reason for our involvement in the Middle East over there, that it is immense profits being routed to the same folks. Am I
well,
going
Dave,
off the deep end?
No, Dave, I agree with you. One of the reasons why I'm really glad that Ms. Yuhas is here on my show is because I've heard these statements, I've made these statements, we all know about no-bid contracts to Halliburton, but she's talking about something that until I read her article in the LA Times, I didn't realize went even deeper, that we have structurally put in place in the Iraqi government anti-democratic orders that cannot be overturned, that keep American corporate interests in power. Ms. Yuhas, you explained this in your article. Explain how, I mean, someone might say to you, okay, fine, Bremer put in these orders, but now we have a new Iraqi government. They can just abolish all those orders like any sovereign nation, can't they?
Mm-hmm. You'd think they would be able to, and we thought they would, actually, because one of the other important things to say about the orders is that they're completely illegal under international law. I think they would be able to, and we thought they would, actually, because one of the other important things to say about the orders is that they're completely illegal under international law. There are very specific requirements for what an occupying nation can and cannot do. One thing they can do is make sure the water and electricity run, which our government has not done in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
One thing they cannot do is fundamentally restructure the economy.
Well, now tell me, why can't the new Iraqi parliament that will be elected in January overturn these orders that Bremer issued?
Basically, the very last day that Bremer was in office, in the 100th order that he passed, he handed over all authority for the orders to Iyad Alawi, government of Iraq. And Alawi, as I think most of your listeners probably know, is the person who has cannot turn them over. Then even
he has to prove that it would have no impact, that there would have no change.
Yes.
That's like saying, all right, America, you can change this law as long as you prove that changing the law has zero effect. What's the point of changing a law that has no effect?
Exactly. Because the condition put on the interim government is that it's only supposed to run Iraq until an election can take place, which I think is perfectly fair. It's not supposed to be doing any fundamental changes.
Okay, but after January 2005, the conservatives that listen to this show that support the president would say, okay, but then they can change these orders, right?
Well, again, it's very difficult. So the first thing is if there's even going to be an election in January, and you know, I for one am feeling very nervous about that fact. And speaking to people on the ground in Iraq, nobody believes that there can possibly be a fair election by January. Even assuming that there is an election and there is a government, elected a government in place, again, the requirements are three-fourths of the what will then be a National Assembly, would need to agree to turn over the order, including
3/4.
Yeah.
A supermajority.
A supermajority. And again, it's most likely that these are going to be people heavily favored by the United States. So you have to get, you know, sort of U.S. people to agree to turn over U.S. laws.
This sounds like this, the governments the Soviets installed in Eastern Europe.
It does sound very much like that. And the other piece is that part of the orders, which is more incestuous, put in place inspector generals in every single Iraqi ministry that were U.S. appointed that have five-year terms. So that means they're in there in every single ministry for 5 years.
Our guys, the people of the United States appointed.
Controlling the money. They also have contract authority. So getting back to the money, there's $24 billion unspent of U.S. taxpayer money that was supposed to be devoted to the reconstruction, basically completely unspent. That money is going to be by far the largest amount of money that exists in Iraq for a very long time. The U.S. government has control of that money, and then within the Iraqi government, the U.S. appointed attorney generals and inspector generals.
There's so much going on here. I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get to it all in an hour, but Dave, let me ask you if you have any specific questions for Antonia before I let you go.
Well, the constructing 14 large military bases sounds like we have a long-term plan to protect just what's happening, but do you think that Kerry and Edwards have a clue as to how psychopathic this administration is?
That's a great question.
I don't know that Antonia knows that. That's a tough question for her, but I'll give her a shot. Do you think Kerry realizes the permanence and significance of all this money going to U.S. corporate interests?
Well, the first thing that I would actually do is turn this around to your listeners and say one of the things that has to happen is this information needs to get out more broadly, and those of you who are Kerry supporters need to demand of Kerry a response to the economic invasion. And a guarantee. I will guarantee you that Kerry and Edwards know about all of this.
I mean, they mentioned Halliburton. I thought was very strong in his debate in mentioning Halliburton so much that Cheney changed the subject.
Yeah.
But I don't think, and maybe part of the problem is that people don't have shows like I do where we devote a whole hour to a single topic. Usually it's Halliburton gets at best 2 minutes and then that's people move on.
Exactly.
But, you know, this thing about the orders, the Bremer orders, until I read your article, I'm pretty well informed on this kind of stuff. I didn't realize the way we had sort of stuck our tentacles into Iraq and left them there. I did know, and Dave made a very good point mentioning the 14 military bases, which, by the way, Dave, to Kerry's credit, he did mention in one of the debates. He specifically mentioned that the fact that we're leaving military bases behind shows the Arab world that we intend to stay and leads to some more terrorism. Kerry specifically mentioned that. I got to give him credit for that. But no one until you, Antonia, have I seen talk about these orders. Now, I assume it's public information,
mm-hmm.
but has anyone reported this? CNN, New York Times? I'm glad the LA Times reported what you said, but
yeah.
Why aren't people following this? They just don't know?
Well, there's been a few stories, actually. The Wall Street Journal has done the best
Interesting.
Following it. But I do think mostly it's not well known at all. You know, it takes a very particularly informed reporter to follow this information. And I think it's also something that the administration is very interested to not have.
I'm sure.
Reported.
One last comment, Dave.
Thank you, Antonio, and thank you, Mark. You're both doing a wonderful thing here.
Thank you for calling in. We got to go to commercial break, but there's still a lot more to talk about. I'm going to get the specifics of what these orders are, what they do, and why they can't be overturned, who is profiting from these orders, and how those profits find their way back into the Republican Party. And another question I'm going to ask Antonia when we come back from break is one that I seem to get whenever I say I think this war is being fought for oil, and I talk with conservatives all the time. You folks know every Tuesday we have a Republican on the show. They usually respond, oh, Mark, that's silly. This war couldn't have been fought for oil because we're not even making profits off of oil. I'm going to ask Antonia that question as well when we come back. If you want to call in and ask your question, it's easy to do. Just call toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Governor Jeb Bush is out to make his state of Florida the next Florida. In 2000, Jeb used such crude political tactics as illegally purging voter lists to help engineer his brother's 537-vote victory in that election. And now, here he goes again. As one peer of Florida's GOP establishment candidly puts it, a Democrat can't win a statewide election in Florida without a high turnout of African Americans. It's no secret that the name of the game for Republicans is to restrain that turnout as much as possible. The Orlando League of Voters can attest to that. This African American civic group has played a big role in turning Orlando from a Republican stronghold into a city that increasingly votes Democratic. Their reward for getting involved in the democratic process is to have Jeb Bush's state police suddenly come knock, knock, knocking on the doors of some 50 of the league's grassroots leaders. These leaders, mostly elderly black women, find it frightening to be confronted in their homes by armed troopers interrogating them about their electoral participation. They're not charged with any crime. Instead, police say they're investigating vague allegations that some voter fraud might have occurred in this spring's mayoral election. Yet Jeb's own state police honcho wrote in a May letter that, quote, there was no basis to support the allegations, and he declared this matter closed. But it has not closed. Police now say the chief's letter was poorly worded. And the intimidating in-home interrogations continued this summer as the presidential election heated up. Jeb's police action is creating a blanket of fear among the league's volunteers who worry that their perfectly legal efforts will land them in jail. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course Jeb says that there's no political motive involved, but when asked how long the Orlando investigation will go on, police say it might continue right through November 2nd.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first six payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middleman? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital the government does not want you to know. And today we've got a real inside scoop. My guest, Antonia Yuhas of the International Forum on Globalization, is talking about things that every reporter should know. It should be in every newspaper. It's public knowledge. It simply is the orders that our government left in place, the tentacles we left in Iraq when we supposedly turned it over sovereignty to a new government. And it's controlling everything. It's giving money to U.S. corporations, and it's not being reported much. I give credit to the Wall Street Journal for reporting some of this. I happen to read it in the Los Angeles Times, and I give the most credit to our reporter, Antonia Yuhas, for bringing this to our attention and the attention of our listeners. If you want to call in and ask her a question, please feel free to join in the discussion. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP, or you can certainly contribute to the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Antonia Yuhas.
Yeah, this is 464 from Michigan.
Hello, 464. How are you?
I'm all right. I have to apologize. I'm getting a highly buffered feed here, so I'm getting bits and pieces of what's coming out here.
I apologize. If that's happening to you folks, the best way to do it is to listen to the archive when the broadcast is through, and I'm not sure why that's happening, but we'll look into that, 464.
Yeah, I'll do that, but I'm very interested about these orders that have been sent to, or have been implanted in the Iraqi and well, what you would call a conditional government,
right,
shall we say?
It was called the provisional authority, yep.
Right.
Are all the factions of the Iraqi people, the al-Sistanis, the al-Sadars, are they all aware of this? And are they going to keep this as a bone of contention in order to get rid of these orders?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Antonia?
Yeah, they're definitely aware. There's been one of the orders that would have gone the farthest and has received a tremendous amount of local Iraqi opposition was one that would privatize all of the state-owned enterprises, which is everything. Everything is state-owned. So that's all the factories, the water services, the healthcare services, all of that would have been privatized very quickly. And there was tremendous public unrest that stopped that from moving ahead on the ground, although the policy is still in place. The al-Sistanis and al-Sadrs are definitely aware of the orders and have definitely spoken out against them. However, it's just dependent on what sort of political control, if any, they end up having and how that is counterbalanced by U.S.-influenced control.
The front page of the Washington Post today had an article that they did a poll in Iraq, and they found that the al-Sadrs and al-Sistanis, the theocratic is probably a better word to use, the ones that want religion to control the government, that they are polling higher than the Alawi government, and if the elections are allowed to be free and fair, may very well take over the government. What happens if a majority take over the government in the election of January 2005 and they want a theocracy much like Iran, but they don't have the three-fourths majority to take over and undo these orders? Might we end up in a situation where we've got American troops there and a government that doesn't want to obey its own laws that we installed?
I guarantee you that in January 2005, if there is an election, it's not going to be that level of a free election that,
okay.
We're going to have an Iran-style government in Iraq and 140,000 U.S. troops on the ground. It's just not going to happen.
We won't allow it to happen?
Yeah, we won't allow it to happen. And the electoral structure that we're setting up wouldn't allow it either. However, if for some reason, the resistance is so strong and that does happen, then all bets are off. Then I'm sure the U.S. military will leave. I'm sure that, everything we've put in place will just be thrown out with the bathwater. It essentially will be as if we were never there, except for that we're going to continue to try and keep our hands in there. I mean, basically everything that we are doing, the U.S. government is doing, militarily and economically, is to ensure that that doesn't happen. To ensure that al-Sistani does not take over the government.
How are we going to do that in a country that we are claiming is going to be a democracy? How do we control the levers of power when we are supposed to be allowing a vote?
Well, the only vote that's going to take place is for a prime minister and potentially for a prime minister and a president.
Local parliament? That's not going to happen in January 2005?
It depends, and I'm not exactly sure how this is folding out.
Okay.
Basically, a certain percentage of the government is going to be appointed.
Really?
Yeah.
By Alawi?
Person is going to be elected.
By Alawi or by the new prime minister?
By the new prime minister.
Oh, I see. 464, do you have any more questions?
Yeah, can you foresee a situation where U.S. troops, say if Bush is selected, will be fighting Iraqis for the sake of these orders over, say, Iraqis who want to maintain democracy in their country?
Certainly. I mean, what we're going to end up seeing that is on the ground of whether, a corporate presence is allowed to remain. And even on basic things, such as, as I said with the privatizations, it didn't happen right away, but just last month, the head of the Iraqi Public Works Ministry said that she was considering privatizing the water system in order to pay for essential works, and that she has sent out a questionnaire to all of the Baghdad residents asking how much they'd be willing to pay for their water. And I think that we will see a dramatic increase in resistance when things like that start happening, and the U.S. military is going to have to be the ones to quell that resistance. When people can't afford their water, as has happened all around the world, they will rise up and demand that water become accessible. And as has happened around the world, the military will come in to squash that. And in this case, it will be the U.S. military.
That's very, very scary. Hey, 464, thank you very much for your call. Hopefully in 2 weeks we'll have a new president and you will get to have a name again.
Oh, boy, I hope so. I'm waiting.
I hope so, too. Thanks for your call.
Yep.
Yeah, Antonio, 464 is one of our regular callers that refuses to adopt a name until we have a legitimate elected president. His view is that when Ashcroft takes over, he's going to number us, and he wants a nice low number. So,
great.
Thank you very much for your call. Let me go back to the question that I asked before the commercial break, because it's one that I get all the time, and I often talk about my belief that this was a war for corporate interest, a war for oil, and I find not just conservatives, but a number of moderates and even some Democrats who say, you know, I don't like George Bush, but I don't think he's that Machiavellian. And the response I normally get when I make that point is, no, we're not making oil profits off this, so it couldn't have been a war for oil. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, we are, and we will make tremendously more. Chevron Texaco is the corporation that has the contract for marketing Iraqi oil, basically shipping it out of the country and selling it. Their profits have increased 90%, a total profit and increase of $3 billion just in the last quarter of this year in comparison to the same quarter of the previous year.
Now, are the oil fields working? Are we getting oil from Iraq now?
A little bit, not nearly as much as we potentially will. Basically, there's been a lot of degrading of the oil fields, but also targeted assault of the oil pipeline.
So Chevron Texaco is making money now,
yeah,
but they'll make gobs more, to use a technical term, gobs more later. In other words, their profits are up 90%. That's almost doubling, folks. That's a huge number, mm-hmm, for a huge corporation, but it's likely to increase several fold in the future. Is that fair?
Oh, sure. I mean, if everything works to plan, and to say that the Bush administration invaded Iraq for oil is what they said. If you look at particularly the statements in the writings, public statements of Rumsfeld in particular, but all of them, and Cheney, and the members of the Bush administration while they were out of office, when they were trying to get back in, they were very clear over and over again that the United States needed to invade Iraq to guarantee our secured access to Iraqi oil, and to guarantee that access for our allies so that they would not feel the need to build up a military that was as strong as ours in order to defend their own rights to access.
And I should say, I have argued with conservatives and said, look, if it is about oil, you can make that case. We need oil now. I happen to think that if we listened to Jimmy Carter 25 years ago, we wouldn't be so dependent on foreign oil, and I think Kerry actually will help over the next decade wean us from our dependence on foreign oil. But you can make the argument that it was necessary to go to war for oil. I don't make that argument, but my problem is the ones who are pretending it's not about oil and arguing it's about Iraqi democracy or weapons of mass destruction. Well, we know there are no weapons of mass destruction, and as Antonio Yuhas is pointing out, we're actually overruling Iraqi democracy to protect our oil. So if oil was more if democracy was more important than oil for the Bush administration, you would think that the democracy we leave in place could overturn orders that protect American oil companies. And I want to actually specifically ask you about orders that protect. How do these orders by L. Paul Bremer, how do they protect American oil companies?
Well, and oil is just one piece of the economic profit that's sought by U.S. corporations in Iraq. It's very important to understand about Iraq, particularly as compared to Afghanistan, is there is the potential for a lot of wealth. You know, once the money from Iraqi oil does start flowing, the economy of Iraq has the potential to be very, very strong and very lucrative, and U.S. corporations want to have access to all of that money. Even more importantly, though, they want the access that being in Iraq gives them to the rest of the Middle East, which, of course, is a very wealthy region, which has largely kept its doors fairly closed to U.S. corporate access. So we're talking all U.S. corporations, not just oil. What the orders do is eliminate essentially the barriers to U.S. corporate access. So they say that U.S. companies have 100% access to every single business in Iraq. There's nothing that's out of bounds. The oil company of Iraq is still nationalized. So that's why Chevron Texaco just has the contract to market Iraqi oil. The oil sector and all of the economic changes into the oil sector are dealt with in orders and policies that are not public. I do not know what they are, and nor does anyone who doesn't have clearance within the Bush administration.
So there actually are orders, secret laws, if you will.
Yeah, that deal specifically with the oil sector.
We impose secret laws on Iraq that I guess Alawi would probably know them, but our people, it's just not made public. That's amazing.
Yeah, and so what I, you know, the 100 orders that are public, and those are available on the website of the Coalition Provisional Authority, so anyone can look at them. That's cpa-iraq.org. They eliminate any restrictions on U.S. corporate access. They allow 100% ownership of Iraqi businesses, 100%, as I said, repatriation of profits. The money can come back. Nothing is off of bounds. And then they privatize everything that was state-owned so that, again, everything is opened up to U.S. corporate access. And that's a preferential relationship, like we said. It's okay to preference a foreign company in, you know, banking. So the banks can be all owned by American banks. The services, you know, Bechtel has the water contract. They could privatize the water system, for example. That could all be done by American corporations. But the Iraqi government cannot, on the other hand, preference Iraqi businesses.
Very interesting. So Americans get a preference in Iraq, but Iraqis don't.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, when we come back, we got to go to another commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk specifically about the role of Dick Cheney's old corporation, a corporation that no one had ever heard of, I think, or very few of us, 4 years ago, the one that Democrats love to hate, our old friend Halliburton. I want to know specifically how much money they're making, what they're doing in Iraq, and also, what's the quid pro quo? How is it that these companies that are making so much money from taxpayers, are they paying back their Republican sponsors? We're going to have the answers to that. And your questions, just call in, toll free, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back. The next advertisement is by Lie Girls, www.liegirls.com, when you absolutely need the government to lie to you.
Feeling lonely? Terrified? Isolated from the world community? Call now. Real girls are standing by to tell you exactly what you want to hear.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
The economy is growing bigger and bigger. It's so big.
Our girls are dirty and nasty and completely shameless.
America is safer.
Terrorists are going to kill you.
Call now to enter our fantasy world of spin.
We will leave no child behind.
Clear skies.
Healthy forests.
Culture of life.
We're the coalition of the willing.
Hey, you forgot Poland.
They'll be anything you want them to be.
I'm the war president.
I'm the peace president.
I'm a uniter. Not a divider.
I'm a cowboy.
And they'll say just about anything.
The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons.
Mission accomplished.
Call now.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I hope that wasn't too pornographic for you, but I thought it was a very interesting commercial, a new commercial here on the Inside Scoop. My guest today is Antonia Juhas, and we're talking about war profiteering. Now, you probably have heard the Democratic claims that Halliburton is getting no-bid contracts. It's more than claims. It's a fact. Look it up if you don't believe us. Halliburton, of course, is Dick Cheney's old company, but it's much broader than that. What Antonia Juhas, the project director for the International Forum on Globalization, is letting us know is that we have tentacles in Iraq that aren't just military bases, that aren't just a few no-bid contracts right now, but some of these contracts can last 20, 30, 40 years and are practically impossible to overturn, even by a newly elected Iraqi government, even if we allow elections to take place. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And I want to read a comment from James on the blog. You know how to get to the blog. It's www.radioinsidescoop.com. James writes, "The interesting thing is that the Bush family has a rich heritage of profiteering. There's a great book on the subject called American Dynasty. It details how Bush's fathers and grandfathers have profited off of every war since World War I, even selling weapons to the Nazis before war broke out. This is all about the military-industrial complex and how it can best profit from taxpayers' money." Thank you very much for your comment, James. Antonia, I want to ask specifically about Halliburton, because Republicans will tell you that Democrats are making too big a deal out of this, that Halliburton is profiting just like every other corporation, that there's no particular reason to single out Halliburton among the other corporations. Is that a fair criticism?
It's not a fair criticism. Halliburton is far and away the largest profiteer.
How much money are we talking about here?
$18 billion in reconstruction contracts. $18 billion. Now, the second closest corporation in reconstruction contracts is Bechtel at $3 billion.
So they have six times the second largest corporation there.
Exactly, and everything else even dwindles in comparison to Bechtel's contract. So the rest are in the, you know, piddly $100 million category.
And I should note that we all know about Halliburton, CEO, the old CEO of Halliburton used to be Dick Cheney. Bechtel, I believe, George Shultz, former
exactly.
Secretary of State George Shultz was in charge of. So these are not just corporations. These are corporations with leaders that have been in our government, Republican leaders. Now, if a Republican supports giving a no-bid contract to Halliburton, a member of Congress or something, an administration official, supports giving a no-bid contract to Halliburton, are they rewarded in any way?
Well, it appears so. I looked at the Center for Public Integrity's wonderful information, which traces corporate giving in election cycles. And in the current election cycle, which is 2000-2004, Halliburton has given 85% of its corporate giving money to the Republican Party. 85%. It's enormous.
And actually, it's a lot. It's a very good deal for Halliburton, because they're getting $18 billion and they merely have to dole out a few hundred thousand to Republican office holders. So when you think about it, just do a little arithmetic there, you're getting some $10,000 for every dollar you spend. That's quite an investment.
Yes.
You really can't blame them for buying off politicians. You know, I remember when congressmen used to be a lot more expensive. I mean, you'd have to pay $500,000 to own a member of Congress. But apparently Halliburton gets a discount rate and can buy so many congressmen for a much cheaper rate. Who are the other companies? Bechtel, Halliburton, I think you mentioned Lockheed as well.
Yeah, Lockheed Martin has just absolutely seen their profits go through the roof thanks to the Bush administration. Their stocks have tripled in value since 2000.
And of course, it's interesting to me that right at the exact same time, the Bush administration has cut the tax rate for dividends,
mm-hmm.
so that if you're a shareholder, you've done very well, in fact, if you're a shareholder. Now, but let's say you're not a shareholder of Halliburton or Lockheed or Bechtel. Let's say you're an ordinary American citizen or an ordinary Iraqi citizen. Let's start with the Iraqis. How much money, and we've given, it's up to $200 billion authorized right now, how much of this reaches the ordinary Iraqi citizen?
Well, the only way that it could possibly reach the Iraqis is if they were hired to do some of the reconstruction.
Okay.
So, or given the contracts. And basically what we've said is they're not getting the contracts. The money's not being reinvested in Iraq. Instead, it's all coming back, and much of it going to Republican Party coffers. The only way at this point that they could benefit is if they were getting hired, which they're not. There's still a ridiculously enormous unemployment rate in Iraq. Basically, one of the orders that Bremer put in place was de-bathifying the entire Iraqi infrastructure, which means anyone who had anything related to the Ba'ath Party.
Which was Saddam Hussein's party.
Was Saddam Hussein's party. And basically, if you wanted to get a job in Iraq, you needed to become a member of the Ba'ath Party. Every member of the military was let go, and then some 30,000 key government officials who were running, you know, these are doctors, these are teachers, these are engineers, were all summarily dismissed as well. Unemployment is still rampant in Iraq, and basically the reconstruction isn't happening. The latest figure I've heard is that some 20,000 Iraqis have been hired in reconstruction efforts, and that's just at some point. So one thing that Bechtel has done is done subcontracting of its work.
Antonio, are you in Iraq right now? I hear sirens in the back.
This is the crazy streets of San Francisco.
Okay.
And those are people who get hired, you know, for maybe 2 weeks. But then they get counted as one of the 20,000.
Well, let me ask about something very basic. I mean, one of the things that Iraqis complain about, obviously, is security, because they went from a very secure society with very little crime to a lot of anarchy and danger in the streets. But what about something basic, like water, like electricity? Are these things functioning?
And so this is the major tragedy, I think, of you know, the lasting impact of the invasion, which is, if you look at the U.S. government's own website, USAID, they provide just a devastating portrait of what the water and electricity situation is. Basically, water is not running. There is raw sewage literally flowing in the streets of Baghdad because the sewage system is not working. Water is not reaching a majority of the population. What is reaching them is untreated, and we're seeing immense increases in cholera and other water-borne diseases, particularly among children. Also, the electricity is not running at all reliably, nor reaching as much of the population as it was before the war. And this means that hospitals face long periods without any electricity, schools, homes, businesses, the streets, which makes it unsafe. And, of course, electricity is needed to run all the other systems, including water. And it, just the infrastructure is completely devastated. And, again, like I said in the beginning, the one thing that the United States government was required to do in Iraq was to make sure that the infrastructure was running. It's one of the requirements of an occupier. And we have simply fallen in that. And we're still paying out billions of dollars, however. So Iraqi citizens know that Bechtel has a $3 billion contract to rebuild their water systems. They know that their water isn't being provided. And you know that this has got to be absolutely fueling the intensity of the resistance. Not only are their services not being provided, but U.S. corporations are making billions of dollars, and people are sitting in the streets watching their children play in sewage.
And, of course, for Americans, we don't have it as bad as the Iraqis, but we're using our taxpayer dollars, which eventually we'll be taxed on for. I know Bush loves big debt, but eventually we got to pay it back. We're paying for this, and the money, again, seems to be going to the corporations with little accountability. I mean, is anyone watching to see how this money is being spent?
There's been some very good single members of Congress who have been trying to, particularly on Halliburton, get the U.S. government.
Who's good? That's good to praise a member of Congress when they do a good thing. Who are these people?
Yes.
Name one or two.
And Henry Waxman.
Henry Waxman of California. My old congressman when I lived in Los Angeles. Go Waxman.
Yeah, he's definitely leading the struggle. You know, he's having limited success, and the only success he's having is really on Halliburton, you know, watching this one corporation. And it's really been up to citizens groups like my own to try and track this money and keep tabs on it. And there's a very good website called CorpWatch, CORPWATCH, that is doing a good job. And folks can look at my website as well, ifg.org, for International Forum on Globalization. But basically, the accounting is woefully inadequate, and actually the U.S. government doesn't even know how many contracts have even been given out.
Antonia, I was really impressed with the two articles you wrote in the Los Angeles Times. How can someone find those two articles?
Again, on my website, which is ifg.org, they're both posted. And again, I would like to give my props to the Los Angeles Times for printing this material. They even printed a letter to the editor in response to one of my op-eds that said, "Shame on you, Los Angeles Times. This should have been front page news, not back page commentary." And they printed that letter.
and of course, it's sad that the one we praise the most is the one that puts you in the back pages,
yeah.
Because they're better than the ones that aren't printing what you're saying at all. Let me just close. I got two more questions for you. We only got a few minutes left. But one of the orders that we haven't yet discussed, one of the Bremer orders that you talk about, is one that actually gives foreign contractors immunity from Iraqi laws. In other words, if a foreign contractor goes in and kills an Iraqi, you know, accidentally or intentionally, they can't be prosecuted in Iraq. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, obviously the most extreme version of that is the mercenaries that have been hired to do quote-unquote security in Iraq, the armed mercenaries. They are operating with full immunity from Iraqi laws. And so are the corporations. So if, for example, there's an oil spill caused by Halliburton and someone's, you know, acres of land are completely contaminated, they would have to somehow get to a U.S. court to argue under U.S. laws that they need some form of compensation. And obviously the likelihood of that happening is incredibly thin.
I do think it's important that Americans try, as hard as it is, to put themselves in Iraqi shoes. We certainly had 200 years ago, 200 plus, Great Britain control us in a way we didn't like. And the French came in and helped us, and certainly we were glad to see the British gone. But imagine if the French, in addition to helping us, had set up our laws, set up our constitution, insisted that it couldn't be changed even by American votes, and at the same time insisted that the French could go around and kill Americans with impunity. I would think we would have immediately turned around the revolution from being an anti-British revolution to an anti-French revolution, even though we were happy that the French helped us get rid of Great Britain in the American Revolution. I think it's important just to think, just for a second, put yourself in the mind of an ordinary Iraqi citizen who did not like Saddam Hussein, but at least had water and electricity and had Iraqis getting the profits from Iraqi oil, and think how they must think of what the Americans are doing. And I think if you do that, you can understand that the people in Iraq are not all al-Qaeda terrorists out to kill us. Some of them are. Some of them no doubt are. But I think most of them are people who are simply trying to run their own country. And I guess my last question to you, Antonia, is, and it's the impossible one. You only have about a minute and a half to answer it. But where does the future lie? I mean, what do you predict is the most likely to happen if Bush is president, if Kerry is president? Where's Iraq going to be 5, 10, 20 years from now? That's a possible question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway.
Okay. You know, I am an eternal optimist. I think information is the most empowering tool that people can have, and I think the more demand there is to either administration, whichever one we end up with here in the United States, that these orders are eliminated, that we demand real democracy take root in Iraq, that's all we can do and all we can hope for. And really, sadly, that sort of power lies with us because it's our government that is running Iraq and controlling it. And so the Iraqis, you know, obviously are doing everything that they can to take power back for themselves. But we have an immense responsibility to hold our government accountable for its actions in Iraq. And if we do that and if we are adamant in that process, I think, you know, a positive future is always possible. There's been amazing thinking in Iraq, around the world, on what a positive reconstruction could look like, what real democracy, a real shift to democracy in the hands of Iraqis could look like, and it's not that hard to shift in that direction, but it demands are working for it.
And one last point that Antonia makes in her article, these laws are illegal. It is illegal under international law and under American law, in the treaties, the Hague treaties we sign, the U.S. Army's law of land warfare, it is illegal for us to occupy a country and to fundamentally change its legal system, its economic system. Even the British Attorney General, in a leaked memo, again, this it's not my inside scoop, Antonia gets the credit for this, but in a leaked memo to Tony Blair, warned that these kinds of laws are not authorized by international law. So I do think if Kerry becomes president, it's more likely for him to permit the Iraqis to take more control of their own lives, which at the end of the day I think means less attacks on Americans and a sooner coming home for our troops there.
Yeah.
Antonia, thank you very much for a fascinating hour here on the Inside Scoop.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really appreciate it. Tune in Sunday. Sunday is my interview with Florida elections officials. I take on Jenny Nash. She's the press secretary for Glenda Hood, the Florida Secretary of State appointed by Jeb Bush to replace Catherine Harris. She's a former Bush elector, so I wonder how partisan she is. It's a fascinating discussion. We are devoting all of Sunday's show to Florida. We've talked about other voting problems in other states. This is not a rerun. The